May 23rd, 2017, I'd like to call the Senate Education Committee to order. We had, first up, we had the Bynum Vial HB 3267. We're going to pass over that and start with 3029, and Representative Hayden can come forward. There are no other individuals who have signed up to testify with regard to this meeting. If the staff will provide a summary, we'll get started.
Vice Chair Linthicum, and members of the committee, House Bill 3029 exempts children from attending full-time public school for 1 year if their parent or legal guardian notifies the school district they will delay such enrollment to meet the child's needs for cognitive, social, or physical development. The bill allows a determination to be made by the parent or legal guardian. Takes effect July 1st, 2017.
Okay, Representative.
Thank you, Vice Chair, members of the committee. My name is Cedric Hayden, State Representative for House District 7. You have a bill brought to you with bipartisan support, unanimous out of the House Education Committee and unanimous on the floor. The intent of this bill is fairly simple. Currently, the mandatory school age is 6 years old to start school. On OLS meeting materials, you will find some information that I've put together that it might be appropriate to have an exemption to that in certain very, very limited cases. I've worked extensively with the Oregon Education Board and the Oregon Education Association to come up with what in the House was a consensus agreement on language to make that work. One of the meeting materials talks about the phenomenon of birth age, and what I used was a sports analogy of baseball in Little League. We went back and did some research on that, and this is not scientific research. It was an opinion piece with some data that was pulled from Major League Baseball, and they determined that, going back to 1965, that Major League Baseball players, 12.2% of those players had a birth date of August, and 6.4 of those players had a birth date of July. And so they took a look at Little League. Why would that be? And the theory is that the child that had an additional 12 months to develop with their peer group would end up being more successful long term because they were able to develop. And because of that, Little League actually in 1996 changed the date of the time that you enter back to April to kind of offset that. This plays out in other sports. If we apply that to our education system and take a look, I used, again, in the meeting materials, Portland Public Schools has a talented and gifted program, which you have a age of 5 year olds, 5 years, 5 to 6 years now to enter kindergarten. But if your child is talented and gifted, you are able to apply for having your child enter with their peer group ahead of time, meaning when they're 4 years old and some months. Out of the whole educational system, I wasn't able to find data on all the school districts, but I was able to track down 19 reports of students having to do that or taking advantage of that program. When it comes to children with disabilities, sometimes or most of the time they are much smaller, they weigh a little bit less, and they're not able to achieve the cognitive abilities through the school screening process to get to the 110% or the 100% that the school would like to see them. Some of these students are at a lower level due to developmental disabilities, and so the intent of this bill is to give the option to have one more year to let them grow a little bit, to get a little bit older, so that they can simply fit in with their peer group. The original bill was amended. It's an amendment bill that makes sure that this is an extremely narrow exemption that would be allowed. I think probably the 19 talented and gifted students that have that we were able to find that have taken advantage of the early enrollment is probably about the same number of students. If you go back before the requirement of the age of six, there was 86 children that didn't enter school age when they could have entered at 7 years of age when we had that requirement. And so your pool of possibilities is 86, and of those, I was unable to determine from the Department of Education how many of those would be special needs. But having worked professionally in this, a special needs provider for 23 years in the dental field, I know that families worry a lot about, was my child born in August or was my child born in July? And if my child was born just after the cutoff, there's a breath of relief. I don't have a study to show that. I just know that from working with so many families with children with disabilities. And if their child was born just before, so they turn that age just before, there's always a, how are we going to make this? My child isn't potty trained yet. My child isn't able to do the cognitive abilities. Am I going to have to worry about taking diapers to school and things like that? And so it's a burden on the parents. I will submit to you, very few parents are not excited when their child is of school age and ready to go to school. Again, there was only 86 children that didn't enter when they could have throughout the whole state not entered school. But there's a small number of those families that would like the opportunity to delay by 12 months for a very narrow scope of cognitive and physical disabilities so that they can meet with their peer group. My bipartisan support on this bill, I'd like to have Representative Solomon come and also introduce the reason why she joined me on this bill.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the Senate Education Committee. My name is Janine Solomon, for the record. I am a state representative for House District 30, which is Banks, North Plains, Hillsboro, and Beaverton. House Bill 3029 is a very important bill. I heard the testimony on this bill in the House Education Committee, and I felt compelled to sign on as a sponsor. This bill is important for kids and also important to the parents to make sure that the overall well-being of their child is taken care of. Kids with special needs deserve to have this exception so they are able to fit in with their peers. I know as a parent, all I want for my kids is for them to succeed and have a fair shot at life. This bill allows for kids who need more time to take more than 1 year so that they are set up for the best possible scenarios to succeed. I thank the great representative from Lane and Douglas County for bringing this forward, and I hope that you will be joining me in supporting this legislation as a parent and a parent of a special education teacher who understands the need for this legislation. Thank you.
Any questions? Yes, Senator Hass.
Thank you, Representative Hayden. Thank you for bringing this bill forward. The law that lowered the age to six just went into effect last year, right?
That's correct.
So I know what you said, but were there problems? Were there cases where, you know, we hit the rocks or something, or the cases that were, are there problems, I guess, that we're trying to correct?
Well, I know there are parents that have this concern. I don't have a case study for you, but this is a concern within the individual education community that they worry about having to feel like the parents feel like they have to push their child ahead a little bit, where they think that if they could be more mixed with their peer group by delaying 1 year, it would be advantageous to the child. The overall system to the state school system would not be any more in individual education programs. The federal government provides 0 to 21 years of age. The state does put some parameters around 0 to 3 and 4 to 5, and then on 5, K through 12 on up to 21. So we're not trying to change any of that. We're just saying that we want these parents of a small number of children. Again, I'm guessing that it may be 10 or 12 families in Oregon that would take advantage of that and go through that process.
Any other questions? Yes, Senator Gelsar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've talked about this before, so to make sure that it was on the record. This could not be used by a school district to tell a child that they were not prepared to enter kindergarten at age six.
That is correct. Thank you for the question, Senator Gelsar. We were very specific in the language of this bill. That is the parent's choice. I know, because I have experienced this personally, the difficulties with several IEPs in my own family. And this bill will not allow the school districts to say you have to wait. This bill only allows the choice to the parents if they choose to.
And a follow-up?
Please.
Thank you. And that is not a decision that would be within the power of the IEP. This is not an IEP team decision. This is not only a parental decision.
Correct.
Thank you.
Any other questions? So my only question is I also have a need to protect the child. So from my perspective, I look at this and say, there are other services that can be provided to kids with special needs outside of the K-12 system. And sometimes parents want to protect their child so much they don't let them into any of those things either. So they just delay everything for another year to hold on to their child. And sometimes that's not in the best interest of the child. I don't know how we figure that out to make sure that, because most of us, I think, now have come to the conclusion that it is much better to help families and others get this help they need to allow that child to get the best potential, because the greatest time of that elasticity of the brain is when they're young, regardless of whether they're special needs children or regular children. That's the time to invest the most in those kids. How do we make sure that that kind of thing happens? I just have this feeling in me as this principal that I always wanted to make sure that everything I could possibly get for those kids to make it better for them later on is important.
So thank you for the question, Chair Roblin. And yes, that is a significant concern. Again, having spent a lot of time in my professional career with these families, it would be extremely unusual for those families to try and avoid having help through special education. In my experience, those families are always clamoring to get more help. In our current existing law, which is not changed by this, in my opinion, and the relating to clause of this bill doesn't let me fix it, but maybe in the future I can, there is a disconnect between the state's set of 4 to 5 years old with early childhood education, particularly with special needs, that the state's decision, not the federal decision, the federal funds go through 0 through 21. Our state does disconnect those children, and then at 6 years old, they're required to go into K through 12. So there's already an existing gap there that I think you're referring to, that I don't support that gap. That's not what we're trying to change. I would love to close that gap. My opinion of closing that gap would to be give an exemption to let them stay in the early childhood longer, which is allowed under the federal regulation.
Because I, you know, 6 years old was a compromise. There were some of us who really felt it should be younger. So I agree with you on trying to figure out how to
I believe that is a very important but separate conversation.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee? And I see no one else for this bill, so thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
We're going to close our public hearing on House Bill 3029. Usually we like to keep bills for another week to think about. Is there any, or would people like to work this bill? Thoughts one way or the other. Later on, we could do it later. We do. Okay. Thanks. I'll just put that down. That's a possibility. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3267, and we'll invite our guests, special guests from the House, up, and we'll have a short explanation by our committee administrator.
Chair Roland, members of the committee, House Bill 3267 requires school districts or public charter schools to grant waivers for graduation requirements specified by district or charter school to students in grades 9 through 12 who are foster children, homeless, or who have run away from home. The bill requires districts and charter schools to accept for any foster child, homeless youth, or runaway any credits earned by the student in another district or charter school and apply those credits toward the 24 credit hour graduation requirements. The bill defines foster child, homeless, and runaway, applies to high school diplomas awarded on or after the effective date. The A2 amendment adds children in military families, children of migrant workers, or children enrolled in the Youth Corrections Education Program or Juvenile Detention Education Program to the list of students eligible for waivers.
And Representative Biner, is Guy?
Yes, sir.
Arnold here with you? Okay, that's Guy. I wanted to make sure we had all the right people up here. Okay, with that, whoever wants to go first.
Okay, I'll start. Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Janelle Bynum, and I represent House District 51, which is the communities of East Portland, Damascus, Gresham, Boring, North Clackamas, and Happy Valley. So thank you for allowing me to testify today in support of House Bill 3267. I'm happy to report that it passed out of both the House Education Committee and the House floor unanimously. So the bill identifies who falls under the homeless, foster care, or runaway classification, and it allows that they will have one less barrier to contend with to finish high school on time with their peers. And I know that that's a priority for the state. After a meeting with some amazing young people representing foster youth organizations, including Sky Arnold, who's here today, I saw that we could do something significant and low to zero cost to specifically address high school graduation rates. For some background, the U.S. Department of Education indicates that children in foster care often face steep challenges to school success, including high rates of mobility or moving schools. Mm-hmm. When these students move to a new school through no choice of their own, many of the credits that they've already earned often do not transfer, or the new school has additional requirements for graduation beyond the state-mandated 24 credits. So what tends to happen is community service hours are often needed to fulfill diploma requirements that traditional students are able to complete over their four-year high school mm-hmm. career. And these prove extremely difficult for the new students to complete. So what the bill does is it directs school districts and public charter schools to waive high school diploma requirements that are not established by state law if a student is in foster care, homeless, or designated as a runaway youth. You mentioned the proposed Dash 2 amendment broadens the scope of the bill so that students who are in military families are part of migrant worker families, or students who have spent time in the corrections facilities or a detention program can also qualify for the waiver. The goal is to get every at-risk youth through our public education system without costing them anything additional. The bill doesn't diminish our standard of excellence for these students. It provides a more level playing field, I think, for those facing these additional barriers. And I think, just from a personal perspective, forcing kids to hit a moving barrier, I think, is just fundamentally wrong. Two final points I want to emphasize. Students will still be required to meet the 24 credit hour requirement by state law. The number would just be capped. Regardless of the student's school district at time of graduation. And number two, students will still be required to take the requisite subject matter classes, but their earned subject credits will now transfer to the new school district. For example, if money management qualified as math in one school district, the new school district would have to apply that to the math credit as well. In closing, it's my fundamental belief that entering adult life without a high school diploma is just no way to start out. Your lifetime earnings are drastically affected, and it can be impossible to ever catch up. So my call to you is to help us get out of our students away and make sure we have as many high school graduates in Oregon as possible. Thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Rich Vial, House District 26, and I can honestly say this is one of those bills that it was an honor for me to have the opportunity to join with Representative Bynum in bringing to us. It has a bit of a personal application in our lives. Paula and I, Paula, my saint of a wife for the last 41 years, and I had a number of, a large number of foster children in our home over the years, approximately 36. Of those, seven of them ended up becoming permanent members of our family through adoption or permanent application of the fostering program. In every case, those children came to us as teenagers, and in most cases with already some high school behind them. And I can tell you, back in those years, Paula spent a good deal of her time negotiating with the school district to make sure that they could get credit for things that had happened in other locations and that they were able to get through and graduate on time. I'm really blessed to tell you that they all did. They graduated, they got through, they went on to college, they're successful today. But I can tell you that this bill, the application of the principles in this bill would have saved Paula a heck of a lot of time and in some cases some heartache as we worked to get these students successfully through. It is this kind of bill that I feel very strongly. It doesn't cost us anything as a state. There's no fiscal application here. And all it does is encourage folks to recognize that while a community service credit may be absolutely a wonderful thing and should be always encouraged, if it stands between a student being able to graduate, it's something that we ought to reconsider. And I think this bill does that in a very elegant way. So I appreciate your attention and hope that you'll find this something that you can support. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, Vice Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Sky Arnold, and I'm here to discuss House Bill 326723, the number of schools I attended kindergarten through graduation. 42, the number of times I was displaced in the first 18 years of my life. Difficult to place youth, unlikely to graduate, intervention required. The adults in my life not aware that they talked over me instead of to me. If they had asked, I would tell them what I'll tell you. I wanted to graduate without the modified diploma I was being pushed towards. A goal I achieved with much difficulty. I wanted to prove that although I lived in few places longer than 3 months, and some even as short as 2 weeks, I was capable of the most basic human success in life, graduation. I attended 4 high schools, 2 of which were alternative schools that lacked the resources to educate a youth who was learning at grade level, testing above grade level in every area of study. My GPA was lowered as I moved because often I was moved during term and placed in classes I was either finished with already or not yet ready to take on, often put in classes with available seats instead of classes I actually needed. I graduated with over 26 credits total, a GPA of 2.25, and was told I had barely earned the diploma I was being handed. It was difficult enough completing high school, made even more so by my lack of confidence academically. Why would I believe I could graduate if I was being told I was incapable of being held to the same standards as other students and not given the resources I needed to succeed? Credits didn't transfer well due to the differences in how each school district divided terms, resulting in trimester credits being rounded down to semester standards. If I'd only had to satisfy the Oregon graduation requirements, I would not have had to repeat many of my classes written under different names and titles in separate school districts. For example, I took civics twice as a freshman, once as a sophomore, and once as a senior, because civics was written underneath U.S. citizenship as an elective the first 3 times I completed it. House Bill 3267 would focus on fixing the problems I presented.
Thank you. Questions? Yes.
I had a question. You mentioned that you were pushed to take a modified diploma. Did the school inform you that that's your right to say, I want a standard diploma?
They started pushing me towards a modified diploma when I was about 12. I hadn't even hit high school yet. I was in an alternative school called, I think, Clare House out in Hood River. And I was mixed in with high school students, and I was a middle school student. I was already taking high school classes when I was, I think, 11. I started taking high school classes. I was taking U.S. citizenship when I was 11. I was taking Algebra 1, Algebra 2. And they just kept on
every single time I moved schools, they would like switch me to a lower grade level of math, or they would make me repeat things over and over and over again. And eventually I just got bored and I stopped trying.
Any follow-up?
Yes, please.
And did you have an advocate? Was there, and I mean, was it all on you to advocate, or was there anyone that tried to help say, hey, we're gonna make this about her?
All contact with my family was cut off when I was about 11. And I didn't receive any more contact with my family until I was about 14. And in the midterm, I went through about 3 different caseworkers, and my CASA died. And I went through about 6 months where I didn't have a CASA at all.
I'm really sorry. We should have done better for you. And you have done extraordinarily well, and that is remarkable. So congratulations on you've clearly earned your diploma time and time and over again in ways that other people that may have walked across the stage of the 4.0 and a bunch of credits and merit scholarships probably could not hold a candle to the amount of work and sweat and effort and heartache that you put into getting there. So congratulations. It's a really big deal.
Thank you.
Other questions? I just want to thank you for the bill. It drives me crazy that I didn't think of this a long time ago. As a high school principal, this is one of my most frustrating things, and we used to have real conversations with our counselors about, I don't care what their transcript looks like, would you talk to the kid and find out what happened? Because in a whole bunch of these cases, especially with foster kids, there didn't seem to ever be an understanding with the caseworkers and with the system that semesters and stuff ended at certain times. And so we get these kids that would transfer, and they missed the last week of the semester, and they came in the first week of the next semester, and we'd call back to the school and say, what grades they had? Well, they didn't get any grades. They didn't finish out the semester. And so we'd tell our counselors, that's not the answer we wanted. What were they doing? How much work did they, what grade did they have at the end of the deal? Please send us that, because we'll give them the credit for the course if we have to. We'll figure it out. But it's extremely frustrating, not only for the kids, but for the schools. I mean, it drove our counselors crazy, and we insisted that they find out where they were, how much had they earned, what did they need to finish, and we had a right to ask them, send us the homework that was needed for the last part of that semester, and we can figure it out, and we'll have them do it. We'll send it back to you if you want to give the credit, or we can do the credit. But it takes a lot of work, and to leave that to a student is impossible. Even with a school, it's really tough. But it happens over and over and over again. And the other one was with the military, which I'm happy you put in here, because they transfer at different times. They try to do it the right way, but what you do is you get a transcript from Georgia, and they have totally different requirements. And so our issue was call and ask if they were on plan to graduate, because we will figure out how to make them on plan to graduate here. So this bill really sets all of those things into place in, I think, a relatively simple way of saying, figure it out, school districts. And the extra credits that some school districts have, I understand that, but I really think that's not an option I ever thought about taking. So I'm pleased that you have that idea. So any other questions or thoughts? Thank you all for being here. And again, I think this bill's not ready. We haven't got all the paperwork yet, but when we get it, we will put this on for a work session at the next meeting. So we're going to close our public hearing on House Bill 3267, and we will carry over House Bill 3267 for a work session.
On the 30th.
On the 30th. So now we're going to open, should we just go down? Yeah, I might as well. We're going to open House Bill 3181. For a public hearing. We don't have all the paperwork here for this one to move it today, but we anticipate moving it at the future. So with that, welcome back, Representative Hayden. This has become your committee lately. And we'll have an explanation from our administrator.
Chair Roman, members of the committee, House Bill 3181 creates an exemption for students who are 7 years of age or younger from the requirement to provide a certificate stating that the student received a dental screening within the previous 12 months, provided the parent or guardian submits a statement. The bill specifies components of the explanation statement for the reason that the dental screening is a burden for the student or the parent or the guardian. It specifies how the Oregon Health Authority summary shall be submitted and the contents of the summary. The A5 amendment requires schools to issue specific instructions to students, parents, or guardians.
Okay. Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. My name is Cedric Hayden, State Representative, House District 7. In 2015, Representative Kenny Geyer and I worked with the Oregon Dental Association and also on the behalf of the CCOs to determine whether, well, to get dental screenings into the educational process of their vision screening, their physical health screening, their vaccinations, and a dental screening. As that bill was developed, it was basically a checkbox of you had a dental screening or you didn't have a dental screening. And that was a good improvement. We're excited to get that as part of the intake information when a child enters school. Going forward 2 years, working with the dental organizations, the ODA, we have determined that it would be more beneficial to be able to target populations entering school that don't have a dental screening as of why. In the House Healthcare Committee, around March, on March 15, we had a company come in that showed us all the states of dental screenings, and the state of Oregon is unfortunately one of the lowest states in the U.S. On dental screenings. Only 42% of our population gets a dental visit, and it should be higher. One of those efforts is to try and determine why these on the no box, if a student checks a, or if the school checks a no box, they report back through the OHA. But the dental organizations that try and provide this community benefit don't have the information of what is this population, who is this population, how can we target to get these dental screenings. And it may just be that the child has a commercial dentist and they don't need it, and that's fine if they're getting the dental screening that should be marked that they get that at through their private or commercial dentist. But what they're finding is that the no box doesn't give them information to target. And so this bill is kind of considered a technical fix. We worked with it on the House side and got it moved forward. I see there is Senator Roblin has added a dash 5 amendment to it. I am certainly opened to making this work for everybody, coming up with a consensus. My only concern would be that there would be a fiscal added to that. If we can work around a fiscal, I am supportive of whatever works. And so I'm available to answer any questions on the dental side of it. I think we have some technical language people behind me here.
Any other questions for Representative? My only question is, we keep asking schools to do more and more with less and less, and the time commitments of this kind of stuff that take away from the general deal. I actually do believe that the more screenings and the more kinds of health things we can take care of earlier, the better, more likely it is that student can take advantage of all that. But if you start collecting information, then you've got to figure out how to get that collected information to somebody else. And it just makes me nervous. Is there organizations out there and others that are willing to help with some of that kind of stuff, and to then what to do with the data after we get it?
Yeah, I believe that there is. Thank you, and that's an important concern. That is the concern, the fiscal, the time that it takes to get it. If I had my wish for a day, I would like to get the coordinated care organizations combined with the dental care organizations to become part of the school health system. Under the Oregon Health Plan, there is significant dollars set aside for community benefit that could be used for that. We don't require that, but I think there are solutions out there, but we need data to drive those recommendations, such as metrics within the health system, to get some of that assistance into school-based health care.
Thank you. Yes. Senator Lippman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What sort of I find the language interesting where it says screening is a burden for the student, and I'm curious what information you're expecting to see in that screening is a burden arena. The only one that's obvious here in the text is the cost is too high, and it seems Since this is at the request of the Oregon Dental Association, it seems like there's a tie. Now that we've collected the data in future years, there will be a funding requirement on top of what the chair was just describing with asking schools to do more with less. There will be an additional funding requirement, and the Oregon Dental Association is certainly going to profit from this, now seeing funding come through for dental checking of every student that comes through the door. And there are no other parameters for the burden. What parameters would you expect to see parents and students highlight?
So, being a dental care provider for 23 years and a portion of that a special needs provider, when something says a burden to the child or patient, if you will, for a dental screening, a child under an individual education program with cerebral palsy or many of the different syndromes that we have may have a physical hardship being able to sit in a chair or being able to lay back in the chair. And so the information there, and I'm getting beyond my detail of this, but the information there, if it's a burden to physically have a screening, it would be nice to know collectively through the OHA how many of these students is because of a physical burden. I mean, is there a need to come into the schools with some specialized providers that would be able to handle it? Are children of special needs not getting screenings because of this issue? So that's an example of a burden, physical burden.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that, we'll call up Morgan Allen and Richard Donovan.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. Richard Donovan on behalf of the Oregon School Boards Association, here with some concerns about House Bill 3181. I know the committee's got a full agenda, so I'll kind of be brief. House Bill 3181, to kind of dovetail off of what Senator Roblin mentioned, represents a further kind of increased mandate on schools. Schools and school districts are compliant and have gone along with the requirements of the bill that kind of ushered in the first layer of dental screening 2972 in 2015. But this bill would put districts in kind of the uncomfortable position of asking parents why they haven't done something for their child, kind of ask them to justify their actions. It would also make the district responsible for data that's potentially student-level identifiable, data that's potentially healthcare-related, and with no clear benefit. I mean, I understand that there's benefit to public health generally, but you know, as the representative who preceded me said, you know, that they've been working with the Dental Association, but you know, districts and kind of education stakeholders would also be like to be part of that conversation. So with that, I'll be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Morgan Allen here on behalf of COSA. And as we mentioned before, in 2015, the legislature passed a new mandate to school districts about dental screenings and collecting that information. And that was work for our folks, but we understood the purpose. Dental pain and dental issues are one of the preventable and curable problems for student attendance issues and academic problems, and we know that. And so we felt that was an appropriate thing to do. But our primary concern with the bill as drafted and with the A5 amendments is that we're beginning to require districts to collect information and ask questions about why parents are not taking their kids to the dentist, essentially. And our concern is that the more intensive or intrusive you make those queries to parents and families, it might actually have the opposite effect. You know, when we talk to our school health folks, when you start asking more detailed questions about why you're not doing things for your children, that you might start getting less response to those things. The bill does add more data requirements, and again, we've talked to the proponents. This bill really came to our attention as it made it through the House. It didn't raise any flags for our folks, but as people looked at it more and started to look at the dental screenings and saw the amendments, it started to raise some flags because we're unsure what the data is for exactly. And I've talked to the proponents, and they've talked, well, they'd like the data to be able to target some of their philanthropic efforts or other efforts into areas where kids are not getting dental screens. Well, I can tell you where kids aren't getting dental screens. It's where there are socioeconomic challenges, and it's when there's poor kids. So that's places where kids aren't getting dental screens. So I don't understand why getting more information about why people aren't taking their kids to the dentist. We know they're not taking their kids to the dentist, and we should just deal with that directly. A couple of other things. The bill has an emergency clause. So, and here's an interesting thing. I'm not sure I've ever seen this in 10 years. This is a new mandate that was passed in 2015. We haven't even finished the first data collection, and we're already changing the data collection. So let me just make that clear. So school districts are in the process of collecting data for the first time for something that was passed in 15. And here we're adding some pretty, what I would consider significant changes to that data collection before we even get the first set of data back. And that's concerning for us. It's, you know, it's a perfect example, whatever you want to call it, moving the goalposts, or why are people sometimes get frustrated with well-intentioned bills. Again, don't have any issues with what people are talking about. So I think at this point late in the session, we're certainly willing to sit down with the Dental Association folks and try to engage all the stakeholders, which needs to be not just school districts, but probably the Department of Education and the Oregon Health Authority. Because again, school districts are not the healthcare experts. And as you know, over the last few sessions, we've been asking school districts to do more and more related to healthcare, and that's appropriate, but we're starting to get to the limits of the expertise. And so we would ask you not to move the bill this session. And instead, we would be willing to throw out the offer of trying to engage stakeholders during the interim and see if we could come back with something in 2018 that, from our perspective, could improve the data collection and meet the needs of the Dental Association and other folks if they believe that the law that they just passed in 2015 that they wrote is not sufficient to get information they need. We'd certainly be willing to try to work with them in the interim and see if we can come back in 2018 with something that's not completely kind of redoing something that's just getting started. So thank you.
Any questions? Thank you both.
Thank you.
With that, we will call up Georgia Kulich and Melissa Freeman.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is George O'Coolidge, here on behalf of the Oregon Dental Association, here in support of House Bill 3181, both, I would say, the bill that came over from the House side unanimously, as well as the A5 amendment to the bill. So just wanted to sort of go back historically. You know, this was our bill back in 2015. It was a collaboration, I think, between the Department of Education, the School Boards Association, Oregon School Nurses Association, a number of stakeholder groups to really look at, you know, the issue around kids' oral health. You know, I think there's a number of reasons, but Oregon tends to come up near the bottom of the list when we look at oral health. I think a lot of folks in our community would probably believe that part of that is a lack of state water fluoridation. But as a result, we have looked at alternative ways to try to identify some of the problems we're seeing. And I just, to put on the record, a couple of, you know, the last Oregon Smile survey said, you know, that 52% of children between the ages of 6 and 9 have a cavity. That's about 66,000 kids in Oregon. More than 17,000 children have rampant decay, which is 7 or more teeth with untreated decay. And as many as 3,800 children in grades 1 through 3 suffer from dental pain or infection on any given day. We continuously hear that one of the number one reasons or number two reasons, depending on what study you look at, of why kids are missing school days is because of oral pain. And so the concept behind this was really, look, before a kid enters kindergarten or reaches the age of 7, let's have a health care provider take an initial look into a kid's mouth. The goal, you know, from our association would be that they have a dental home and that these kids are being seen outside the school district. That would be the hope, but we know that certainly that isn't the deal for every kid, and certainly that's why we hope to have the oral screening to sort of identify, look, let's see, you know, who's getting screened, who's not getting screened. We testified back in 2015 that we were hoping to identify what were the reasons were that kids were not having these oral health screenings. So, again, you know, the Oregon Health Authority, you probably, if you were sitting over in Senate or House Health Care, a number of pilot projects that we look at around sealants and varnishes and a number of work that's being done through the CCOs of how they treat kids, that those reasons could be sort of developed into the oral health screenings. And for a number of school districts, they did do that, but they didn't do it for all. And I think that was one of our big concerns early on, and we flagged a lot of concerns with the Oregon Department of Education that, you know, they missed the intent of what we passed back in 2015, and they missed the intent of what a lot of the groups had worked on this came forward. So we said, look, you know, the question that's being asked is, are you having an oral health screening or not? And, you know, we sort of reminded them about the legislative history, that we were looking at the reasons for and against why kids were not getting an oral health screening. Senator, you asked a good question about some of the other reasons, and we see this with just a lot of number of consistent studies in terms of, is it transportation reasons? Is it financial reason? You know, there was a study that was presented in both the Senate and House Health that looked, that says there's a Medicaid dentist within 98% or 15 minutes drive between 98% of kids in Oregon. I mean, that's amazing that there's a dentist that close to students, yet we're still seeing these high rates. So are there other transportation reasons? Are there other reasons because they're not being able to get in to see a dentist? These are very important questions, I think, for the Oregon Health Authority and all of us who really try to address the oral health needs of kids. So, you know, the original bill basically did that. It sort of broke down, you know, what is the burden into three questions, you know, access, you know, transportation, cost, those issues. But then, you know, another question came up, and that was, you know, the school or the Board of Dentistry has sort of their results of how they look at oral health screenings. And this is actually national, you know, I guess language in terms of what nationally they look at in terms of oral health screenings. And it's basically, we say it's sort of one, two, or three. And it's, you know, one, you know, there's signs of no visible signs of an oral health problems. Two, there are visible signs of oral health problems. And three, there's serious problems and a kid needs urgent care. You know, again, that's sort of national screening data that we hope to bring into the conversation. Like I said, I think Salem Kaiser actually uses this language right now in their school district, and they should be proud of that. And we're just trying to make that a lot more consistent with some of the school districts that are not. So hopefully we can work to address some of your issues and hope to see this move forward.
Thank you.
Happy to answer any questions.
Hi, Senator Roblin, Chair of the Senate Education Committee. My name is Melissa Freeman, and I work for the Oregon Community Foundation. I also serve as the chair of our Oral Health Funders Collaborative for Oregon and Southwest Washington. And I'm here in support of House Bill 3181 with these amendments. For the past 3 years now, I've been leading an effort in partnership with Northwest Health Foundation, Kaiser Permanente, Providence Health and Services, the Collins Foundation, Meyer Memorial Trust, the Ford Family Foundation, ADEC, and many of our OCF advised fund donors. We have been funding to the tune of about $3 million an initiative that is an effort to try to improve children's oral health. And we've built this initiative off of a model that got started in Coos and Curry counties called Ready to Smile. We took that program and replicated it in 15 other communities. We either helped people expand their programs or start new ones based on that comprehensive coordinated model for school-based oral health care. We're doing this in partnership with dental care organizations, coordinated care organizations, the Oregon Health Authority, and more. And what I'm most frustrated about, frankly, in terms of this bill is that the intent of this bill was to understand why kids are not getting screened, and then also what are the results of the screenings. If we're going to the trouble to lay out a whole system where kids are being screened, let's at least note, is it a 0, 1, or 2? Do they have any problems? Is there any visible problem? Or is there no problem at all? Or is there a serious problem? It's that simple, and all screeners can do this. And so on the form that the kid fills out to say, yes, I got screened, let's also add a 0, 1, and 2 so that we know collectively across the state how our children are faring in terms of fighting dental disease. I urge your support of this, especially as an education committee and people who are passionate about education, because I can guarantee that all of these funding philanthropic organizations would not have been involved had it not been for the educators who were urging us from communities across the state to say, our children are in pain, their teeth need attention, and it's the number one reason that they're missing school. And so it is with an educational intent here to make sure that kids are not absent from school, that they're graduating healthy and ready to be productive adults, that they get the attention that they need early on in their mouths. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Any questions for either of these people? Thank you both.
Thank you.
So I will talk with the rest of the members if there's concerns one way or the other about this bill. And we don't have the paperwork, so we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3181, and we will carry over House Bill 3181 to work session at the next meeting, and we'll discuss between them what we want to do. Thank you. Now we're going to open a continuation, or open a public hearing on House Bill 2701. We'll invite Heck to come on up because they didn't get to finish their testimony. We'll have a short explanation here and then decide where we want to go. We do have some amendments, and I think you can talk to those as well, at least one of those as well.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, House Bill 2701 eliminates the probationary status designation for licensed private career schools and agents, changes terminology and statute from place a licensee on probation to issue a notice for corrective action. The A5 amendment requires HEC to notify licensees and grant a contested case hearing prior to any further action if HEC determines that a notice of corrective action should be issued. Declares an emergency effective on passage. The A6 amendment adds a requirement that HEC notify the career school that is the subject of the notification upon receiving a written complaint or deciding to proceed to an investigation. It requires HEC to engage with the school and students during the course of an investigation.
So you had to leave the last time a little bit, and you got to hear the testimony from Kai. We also got some more information from Kai. It was also on the website. So in part of the testimony, if you can address some of that, so we have a better idea of what, from the perspective of HEC, what happened and why we're here today about this bill. And
sure.
I know we've had a conversation to try to figure out if there's a path forward with regard to making sure notice and all those kinds are there in case it didn't happen. But anything you can add to this conversation so we can figure out as a committee what we want to do for moving forward. Because there's two amendments, so you know that. The one that Senator, Representative, Kenimer put in, and then the one that we worked out otherwise. So help us by giving us a conversation about what you see has happened and what went wrong or right or whatever with regard to the particular case injunction. I think I'm not sure nothing can be undone there, but I would like to know, for our perspective, how to make sure we have a process that makes people feel like everybody got heard and outcomes maybe not agreed to, but at least felt heard, because we felt from our hearing of the last person that they didn't feel like they were heard, that there was any conversation there. So with that, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Roblin. Members of the committee, for the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director of the Oregon Higher Education Coordinating Commission, and appreciate your patience and continued time and consideration on this bill. Let me just for a moment take a step back, and then I'll address at least a portion of your question, Senator. The HEC oversees two licensing units, our private career schools licensing unit and our Office of Degree Authorization. They both work with private schools in Oregon that grant certificates or degrees. And the purpose of the HEC and those offices with respect to private higher education is to establish and enforce licensing standards that ensure that our schools offer and award high quality certificates and degrees, and that certain protections are in place for students. For example, if a school closes, that they can receive a tuition refund, and we've worked with the legislature on those standards in the past. The other purpose of those offices is to help support what tend to be Oregon small businesses. Regulatory agencies, or dealing with regulatory agencies, is not necessarily easy or fun, and we try to take a supportive approach. We work very closely with advisory committees that help us develop rules and administer those rules for the organizations, the licensees that we work with. And we have a great relationship with our private career schools advisory committee that's made up primarily of private career schools owners and works with us carefully, in particular when we're considering rule changes. Our intent and interest in this bill is to ensure that the process that we use to resolve student complaints that arise from these schools is transparent, that it's not overly complex or burdensome for schools or for the agency to administer, and that it is fair to student complainants as well as to the schools that they attend. So we want a process that's clear, transparent, fair, not overly burdensome. I want to emphasize that we receive a very small number of student complaints from this sector. These are schools around the Oregon, mostly small businesses, led, owned, operated by caring community members who are doing the right thing by students. And frankly, we receive very few complaints about schools from this sector. But when we do receive a complaint, we respond to it. We attempt to ensure that the student has exhausted the internal process that exists at that school. And in a very small number of cases, we begin an investigation. We learn a little more. We work very closely with the school in that. And on a very, very small number of occasions, we take or begin to walk down the path of actually taking regulatory action in order to resolve the student complaint. The debate is sort of about the sort of dash five or the dash six amendments arises, I think, from potential misunderstanding about the existing HEC process and law, how that conforms or doesn't conform to the process that we use for degree granting institutions. And I would encourage the committee to allow Kyle Thomas from our agency to walk you quickly through that. With respect to the particular testimony that the committee has heard and that the House committee has heard related to the school in question, I don't think it would be appropriate for the agency to, in this setting, walk through the sort of complete case history of that. I'm certainly not prepared to do that today. It is clear that this is a school that feels, as you suggested, Chair Roblin, like it was not heard or did not have the opportunity to weigh in on the potential regulatory action that the HEC was preparing to take. We have a different view. We're working in the school and with the school owner throughout the time period of in question, and I don't think that difference of opinion is likely to get resolved today. But I would express on the record here the HEC's continued and abiding commitment to work very closely with schools and with students. I mean, we're in that difficult balancing act where we have aggrieved students or students who feel they have aggrieved coming to the state for remedy and solution. And we're in a balancing act of trying to support students, but do so in a way that's fair to schools as well. And we're certainly committed to trying to maintain that balance and that fairness going forward.
Senator Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Kyle Thomas. I'm the Director of Legislative and Policy Affairs for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Before I begin my testimony, I just want to point out the fact there is a flow chart that's posted on OLIS under my name that describes two processes that exist independently between our sanctions process for the private career schools and our sanctions process for degree-granting schools, and that I think will be helpful to the committee as I walk through my testimony. The first thing I want to emphasize is that the complaint and investigation and the sanctions process that HEC engages in is not one that occurs in secret. It is certainly one that occurs with the knowledge of the school that has a complaint filed against them throughout the entire course of the complaint and investigations process. In fact, that those principles are enshrined in our rule. When HEC receives a student complaint, it requires it to be complete. And what that means is that it has to have the complainant's contact information, school information, the dates and the names of the individuals at the institution the student has a complaint about or is complaining about. It has to have a statement about rules and laws that are violated and conflict resolution efforts. When receiving that complaint, the first thing HEC does, and this is also a responsibility under rule, is attempt to confirm that the student has engaged in the internal complaint resolution process that exists in the school. If that process has not been engaged with, HEC does not accept the complaint. So that's one point of contact right at the onset where the school becomes aware of the fact that a complaint has been filed against them. There is also explicitly in rule an affirmative notification provision where we simply have to notify the school that we have received a complaint. Then comes the process of the investigation. I won't add much more than Director Cannon has already specified, except to say that in any investigation, we have to hear from both sides. And so commonly in the course of a HEC investigation, that would require site visits to institutions. And in fact, that is what occurred in the past. In the event that HEC determines that there are circumstances that warrant a potential progressive level of sanction, we have three options available to us under the private career school statutes. And this is where the flow chart kind of starts to spell that out for you. The first is probation. Essentially what probation is a warning. It's a formal written notice to the institution of deficiencies that HEC has identified in their operations. It provides career schools with 20 days to respond to that notice. And the institutions have options as to how they can respond. They can reply and say, yes, we agree. We are correcting those deficiencies you have identified, and here's how. They can provide contrary evidence that was not provided in the investigation phase or that clarifies evidence that is provided in the investigations phase, or they cannot respond at all. In any event, regardless of the path the institution takes in response to that notification, HEC does not have the ability to fine the institution, to suspend their license, to revoke their license, to take any negative action against the institution unless it later prevails at an administrative hearing. So two of those other options I mentioned, I'll just clarify what those actually mean. Suspension, which would generally be the next level if you proceed progressively, prohibits advertising, it prohibits enrollments, it prohibits recruitment of new students, it prohibits instruction of new students, but allows the instruction of continuing students to continue to progress throughout the period of suspension. It also requires institutions to notify students and post a public notice about that sanction. And that sanction only takes place if the school either declines their right to a hearing or if HEC prevails at an administrative hearing that the school has the option to trigger within 21 days. The last step is, of course, revocation of the license, which is an immediate termination of the license of the school to operate. And immediately the school has to cease all activity. And similar to suspension, the school has the right to trigger a hearing within 21 days. That process I've just laid out for the committee is different than the process that exists for degree-granting schools. And if you look at that flowchart, on the horizontal lines, if you follow across, I've attempted to illustrate for the committee the different levels and their parallels between career schools and degree schools. And the thing you'll notice is that probation for career schools and probation for degree schools are the same in name only. It's been insinuated before this committee that degree schools have the right to request a hearing if HEC is proceeding with a probation action against them. That is technically correct. They do. But what you'll notice if you look at that flowchart is that probation is synonymous or is an analog to the process of suspension at the career school level. And in fact, degree schools have a first level of possible sanction called at risk. It's that status that is an analog to the probationary status at private career schools. And that status also does not carry the right to a hearing. So I just wanted to make sure that that perception that we have two different processes for the same level of sanction, one carrying a hearing and one not carrying a hearing, is clear in the eyes of the committee. So I'll go into there's three versions of this bill that are kind of available. I'll briefly kind of comment on each of them. The first is the version of the bill without the A5 or the A6 amendments that are before the committee. That changes the term probation to notice for corrective action, essentially matching the term, we think, more closely with what the probation is actually meant to accomplish, and that is to provide a written notification to the institution that HEC has identified specific deficiencies within their operation. I think one of the side effects of changing those terms is that, one, you detach it or you divorce it a little bit from what probation means on the degree-granting school side, but really, I think you correct the perception in the eyes of general members of the public or the media or students that there has been some sort of determination of fact or some sort of criminality or some sort of neutral decision made by a detached third party that the institution has committed some act that has merited them being put on probation. So we think that name change is an appropriate name change that allows the institution to continue to operate without kind of the unnecessary side effect of this kind of public misperception of the action that HEC is engaged in. The Dash A6 amendment, and I want to thank Senator Roblin for having the meeting last week where we pulled in one of the proponents of the bill and the Department of Justice, does that same thing. It also enshrines in statute principles that already exist in rule, and that is that the institution has the right to be notified of a pending investigation. And one thing that isn't enshrined in our rule, but as a matter of good investigatory practice, we follow on a regular basis, that the institution has the right to be included in the investigation. And so the HEC would also view that amendment as a good compromise that decreases the stigma associated with actions that we may take that are less serious than the public perhaps perceives them to be. It's the A5 version of the amendment that we view as a bit problematic. And that would require the HEC to prevail at an administrative hearing before issuing a school a notice for corrective action. In essence, we would be required to notice schools that we intend to put them on notice. And so that initial notice would trigger the right for a school to have a hearing before an administrative law judge, where we would then provide evidence to that judge regarding improper operations. And if we prevailed at that hearing, the only right HEC would gain under that amendment is the right to then notify the school about those very same operational deficiencies. So in essence, the A5 amendment creates two identical and duplicative warning periods. So if that becomes the case, one of our chief concerns is we feel that we lose the right to more informally and collaboratively address some of those lesser level operational deficiencies without immediately jumping to the level of the administrative hearing. We also think it has the potential to lessen consumer protection functions that the HEC protects in such that the fact that HEC would have to prevail at a hearing, one, extends a period of time that institutions have before they respond to a notice, and two, by eliminating those informal opportunities, it is more likely that an increased level of sanction would ultimately have to occur. And that's, in fact, one thing that the HEC feels it may have to do in reaction to the A5 amendment. If required to prepare for and prevail at an administrative hearing and incur the cost of doing so, HEC is more likely to do so if it can then proceed to a sanction versus a period of warning, since the cost of engaging in those actions and the staff time associated with engaging in those actions has to be incurred anyway. There's one more comment I'd just like to make. It has been insinuated that HEC has in the past proactively alerted members of the media or issued releases with regard to pending investigations. I want to assure the committee that that is not in fact the case. In the past, we have received requests from members of the media related to ongoing investigations that we have had open. We discovered through that process that the public information law did not protect that information. We did not have the ability to respond and indicate that due to an ongoing investigation, we are not able to provide any comment. I would note also that House Bill 2457, which was just passed out of this committee a few weeks ago and in fact was signed by the governor last week, contains that provision. So in the future, if we have an open complaint in the investigations phase, we will have the ability to protect that information from becoming public, both to the benefit of the student and to the institution that's subject to, of that investigation. And so that's all the comments I have, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
I guess I just have a couple. One, in the current process that we have, which is theoretically mirrored in the set of amendments that we've worked out, notification of the school has to happen. How do you find out whether or not the student has gone through the whole process at the school? You ask them, do you get information? How do we know that they actually did go through the process that the school had? Because I think in our conversation we said every school has to have a process. So how do we know that they fulfilled their process?
Senator Roblin, members of the committee, those processes are typically a little bit more formal, and they would carry with them a written form that the student had to fill out that would start the complaint process at the institution, and that would then carry with them associated documentation. So if the student were to provide that documentation, that would be a clear indication that that process had begun. Just because the student provides that documentation does not supplant the responsibility of the HEC to then notify the institution affirmatively that it had received a complaint. Those provisions of rule exist separately. So there's two separate mechanisms by which a school would become aware of a complaint.
So that's the awareness, but how do they know that they actually did the process? Did you check to see if the student had fulfilled that part of what you said your rules say, is that they've gone through the whole process there first before you would move on to accepting the complaint?
Senator Roblin, it would be the presence of material likely provided initially by the student, a completed complaint form by the institution, a completed complaint form that the institution has available, that would provide initial evidence that that process was engaged in completely on the part of the student.
Sure, Roblin, let me just add, these can get difficult and messy when there's a difference of opinion between students and the school about the extent to which a complaint process existed to the student, to which it was followed, the resolution or outcome of that complaint process. So ultimately, HEC staff is called upon to make judgments, right, about whether a satisfactory process existed and whether the student followed it, but we would use, as Kyle suggested, the types of evidence that Kyle suggested to indicate whether that process was completed at the institutional level.
Would you have contacted the school to ask if, from their perspective, it was finished, or would it only be information provided by the student?
Chair Roblin, I would expect ordinarily that it would. Our determination would take into account the perspective of the school as well as the students. We certainly are in touch with communicating with school officials during the investigatory phase, and that question would be among those that we would be interested in hearing both perspectives on.
So if in fact you have decided that they've gone through that process and you're going to take on the investigation, at that time, in our new procedures, as well as the old procedures, they would be notified that you are taking on the complaint. Is that correct?
Senator Roblin, as I read the -A6, not only would the institution have to be notified that we had received a complaint, but then it would appear that they would then again have to be notified if we elected to proceed with an investigation. Okay. And not only notified, but proactively included throughout the investigatory process.
Okay. So once the investigative process happens, if you, in that investigative process, find that there is substance to the complaint, you currently send out a notice of probation with these schools, not with the other one, but this one. And that notice of probation, as I understand it, is not saying that we're going to take any action. It's going to say we believe that actions taken by your school lead us to believe that we need to find some correction from your school. But it doesn't say to the school, you can't bring new people and you can't do, it doesn't stop any of the things the school can do. That, I'm just trying to.
Senator Roblin, yes, I think you described that very well. Our current probation, and I agree that it's a misleading term, but currently for private career schools, as Kyle has described, that finding of probation is in essence a notification letter to the school that we think there are issues that may ultimately warrant heck action if they're not resolved, but we're not permitted, we're not allowed under the law to impose any sanction against the school based on a probation finding, which is why we argue that it would be inappropriate to apply the right of administrative hearing at the outset. That would essentially say that we cannot send this notification letter. We can't give the school the opportunity to resolve the issue without going into the formal hearing process first.
Senator Roland, I would just very quickly add that we've spoken to the DOJ about affording the institution the opportunity to have a hearing without the presence of an actual sanction. And they have not issued any formal opinion, but essentially it's been implied to us that this would actually be a rather unique situation in Oregon law, that a hearing would have to – we would have to prevail at a hearing without then being able to issue any sort of sanction.
So I'm going to – final question from me. You have sent this notice. It is now the time for the institution to respond how they're going to react to your notice that we're taking these corrective actions, or we don't believe we need to take these corrective actions because we don't think there was anything wrong. At which time, if you don't come to a conclusion, that's when you go to a hearing in which facts are presented to a hearings officer and we go forward. Is that the way it's supposed to be now and the way the one set of amendments would expect it to go?
Senator Roblin, that is correct, with the exception that we do not have to do issue a probationary notice first. If there is a violation that the HEC perceives as serious enough to warrant essentially bypassing that process and moving to a suspension or revocation phase, we have authority under law to do that. That would trigger a right to a hearing.
Okay. On the side of the school?
Yes.
Correct.
Okay.
They would have 21 calendar days.
Okay. Question? Yes, Senator Lithicum.
It appears the part of what you're describing as the administrative process appears the same for private career and degree authorization schools. You've miscategorized the one by calling it probation instead of at risk. And you've miscategorized step two of the sanction process by calling that suspension instead of probation, as on the other side, and you're using your flowchart as the illustrative item here. What was going on that you made one a probation instead of just at risk? Because part of the issue here, if I remember the original complaint, was the news media picks up you're on probation, and bingo, that is the term applied, but it's false in terms of the administrative process. It's not really probation. It's really this at-risk formal notice of deficiency. You have 20 days to respond, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the news media says, oops, they're on probation, and all of a sudden we drain all of the economic possibility from future constituents who might be participating at the private school, and they run like wild hens in the courtyard. This is who did this, and can I find him?
So, Senator Roland, Senator Lindicum, your analysis is correct, and the your perception of the reputational effect that can have on a school is absolutely correct. I would love to say it was intentional or purposeful or I'm sorry, but it predates the heck. These two separate series of statutes were inherited from two separate agencies, and when the HEC was created, they were consolidated under one entity, and they were not amended, and they exist as they do today, as they did prior to the HEC being a regulatory body.
In statute, to be clear, these are terms that are defined by law, which is why the proposal in the dash
six.
Six amendments to change the initial stage of the private career schools from probation to at-risk is one that we think is appropriate, but it is a decision that the legislature has to make.
Follow.
Yes.
You never gave me the net guy's name, so I can
So we'll have to check the legislative history, Senator Linthicum. Chair Roblin.
It was a guy from Palanqua. I don't know who it was. No.
It was nobody on this committee.
That's right. I think you're right there. Okay. Any other questions for these two gentlemen? Seeing none, thank you for being here. We do have a couple more bills that I want to hear. I think we have the data. I feel pretty comfortable. Kai did a good job of explaining where they were last time. I think Senator Linthicum did a good job of explaining why it was really bad in the past and where we need to get to. So the question will be for us as a group to decide which of these amendments does what we think it does and to make sure that we put in statute appropriate remedies so that people get to hear and get to deal with something before action is taken. So that makes sense? Okay. So if there's any other information that people need to get, thank you for sending this guy, and we'll look through that. Make sure that we get it as evidence, and we will take this bill and move the work session to the next on, was that the 30th?
Mm-hmm.
On the 30th.
Tuesday.
Yeah, thank you. So we are going to move that Senate bill, House Bill 2701 to that point. We will have a conversation with each other, whatever, as we get closer. Think about this, see which one of those amendments does what we think it's supposed to do, and we will come back for a work session at that time. Okay. So with that, and thank you again for coming. Thank you for information. And Representative Kenemer, if you have any questions or needs to get us some information, please do so. And with that, we're going to close our public hearing on 2701. Our person is here, so we might as well go to. Pardon? Is that Kenemer again? Yes, right, it is. House Bill 3353, and we're going to open a public hearing. We had a lot of public hearings today. We've got a couple more as well. And we have some work sessions. So we'll figure out if we're going to do a few of these work sessions ahead of time. And come on up as we explain this bill. Representative Kenemer, I think this is your bill. Oh, okay.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, House Bill 3353 requires a school district that is conducting a dental screening on an entire class to provide a written notice with an opportunity for parents to opt out of the screening. The bill takes effect 91 days after adjournment sine die.
Thank you, and welcome, and whoever wants to start, don't forget to identify yourself.
Chair Roblin, really wants to know who members of the committee, I'm just getting over a cold, and so apologies for sounding different for those of you who know me. I'm Mike Shercliffe. I'm a dentist and the president of Advantage Dental. I feel a little strange about coming after the last bill, but hopefully we won't get totally labeled by it, because originally we were coupled with them and they wanted us out. So this bill is, I speak in favor, and this bill came out of the House Health Committee 9-0 and out of the House 54-0. And basically it simply allows for when you send the permission slip home to do a screening, that if you don't get it back, you can go ahead and do it over a period of time. You can go ahead and do the screening. And I'm going to give you a little bit of my history. Chair Roblin knows that I was the oral health representative on the Gang of Six that spent the time coming up with the transformation legislation several sessions back. And we were working on transformation, not just reorganizing the deck chairs. And part of the problem we have with dentistry is we dentists sit around in our little dental offices waiting for people to show up. The bigger the problem, the bigger we get paid, and in a limited resource budget like we have on the Medicaid and especially on oral health, which is a little less than 6% of the spend, it didn't work very well. And because the time the children get to the time we get the disease, it's too late, and we really should start earlier. And so part of what we're about is transforming things. Very frankly, the way we go about having a skate check for kids in the school, in my opinion, is wrongheaded. But that's a topic for another day, because it isn't going to solve the problem. But what we want to do and what we're trying to do, and by the way, we take care of about 300,000 Medicaid folks, About 40% of them are children. What we're wanting to do is take the science out where the people show up and see if we can't get earlier and identify who has needs and those with not needs, treatment plan accordingly. And those that are at risk to go to the system to inappropriately, which is the hospital, OR, ER, or get medications they don't need, as you know about the opioid problems and the antibiotic sensitivity problems. We're trying to find the folks who have problems, then figure out what their barriers are to care, and then hopefully case manage them to an appropriate setting if they choose to do so. And all we want to do with this bill is be able to go to the school. The problem we have today is we don't have a really good way of knowing how we're doing other than we do a survey that says 52% of the kids have a kid. Kevin, anybody in the room never had a filling? 100% of us, almost.
We've got two more bills. So I know. Close to what this was going to be.
I know you do, but the problem with it is, anyway, I'm speaking in favor of the bill, and it's a really simple bill that allows us to do some good work, and it doesn't cause people to have treatment that they don't want it. It actually goes right up to the last minute. If the parent says at the last minute they don't want to, we can still do that. It basically allows us to check kids so that we can see what their condition is, so we can help them get appropriate care so they don't get in trouble.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Senate, and members of the Senate Education Committee, for the record, my name is Sherry Ludwig, and I'm an expanded practice dental hygienist and the director of community dental programs for Advantage Dental. I'm testifying in support of House Bill 3353 because during my 14 years as a dental hygienist providing community-based services in rural and frontier Oregon, I've seen firsthand the problems encountered getting children access to screenings and thereby follow-up to appropriate oral health care. According to the CDC, tooth decay is the most common chronic childhood disease and the number one reason kids miss school. In addition, Oregon is in the process of transforming healthcare where physical behavior and oral health are aligned. My question is, what is the opposition of adding oral health screenings on passive consent when physical health and behavioral screenings can already be completed in this manner in a school setting? School-based services provide the opportunity for early identification and oral health problems and reduces the amount of time that a student is out of class. As in some of these areas where we're providing school-based screenings, a trip to a dental office can take kids out of class for an entire day. The way it works today is if we want to go in and do screenings, they have to send in the paperwork, and we can only screen those on parents who complete it in its entirety on active consent, which ranges between 25 to 50% of the return rate. In some places, it's even as low as 10. So we would like to... The intent is to provide an option that allows schools to provide written notice while at the same time ensuring parents that don't want their children screened have the ability to do so. So if you look on, I presented at the House Health Committee and on OLIS, you will find images of actual students who have been screened various counties across Oregon to see the level of disease that's out there and to provide images so you have a better understanding.
And again, very brief. And
I'll be very brief. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jim Bunn. I represent Advantage Dental. I want to thank Representative Kinnemer for being the sponsor of this bill. A couple of quick points. One, this is not a mandate. This is not a mandate on schools. Two, there is no cost to the school, no cost to the family. We don't make money off of this. We do this at our cost to the entire population, not just our members. And we're also trying to expand this to adults, too. This is take a quick look, see if there's a problem, and be able to address it. Thank you.
So question of the group. Really, all the bill does is say, instead of getting permission notes ahead of time, we can do the dental screen unless the parent says, get me out of here.
Absolutely. We have to send a written notice. It can be an email. It can be on paper. But we have to notify them. They can choose to opt out. Otherwise, we go forward. Unfortunately, we've had 3/4 of the kids not bring a note back in the past in some areas, and that's a failed screening.
Mr. Chair, I'd just point out, you know, Mike Shercliffe used to be in Douglas County. Based on his testimony, we took a vote and asked him to move to Eastern Oregon. Just kidding, Mike.
Chair Roblin, I don't want to have to tell any stories on the good senator to my right here, but if he's going to tell stories, I won't do that. No.
Okay.
We go way too far back. Thank you very much. Thank you all.
I think that's all that are signed up for this bill. And again, committee members, everybody feel pretty good. We'll decide whether we can work this today. I don't think we're going to have time to, so we'll probably carry it over. So we're going to close our hearing on House Bill 3353, and we're going to, I see I've got both representatives there. Who has any testimony? There's none on this one. So the only person that's going to come up and talk on the Senate bill, we're going to open up
House Bill
3409 is Representative Evans. Keep it short, Representative Evans, so we can get to Representative. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Chair. I will point to the fellow who came to speak today. We'll try to keep it very brief, but there was no paper when we got here, but that's okay. Senator Roblin,
bring him up with you.
Okay. Senator Roblin, members of the committee, I am Paul Evans. I represent House District 20, Monmouth, Independence, West Salem, and parts of South Salem. I'll keep my testimony very brief. This bill, House Bill 3409, as amended, passed 9-0 out of committee, passed 56 ayes, 4 excused off the floor. It is truly, swear to goodness, the idea of a fix-it bill. For some time, the federal government has been interpreting the law in a particular way. For almost 12 years, the gentleman to my left has been doing business, helping foreign students come, spend money in our communities, learn about our culture, do great, wonderful things. And then the federal government decided that they had been misinterpreting the law. And the fix right here is for non-immigrant visas. Non-immigrant visas. It has nothing to do with anybody else, but non-immigrant visas. Folks who want to come here, folks who want to learn here, this will enable the continuation of some education facilities around the state. And with that, I urge your aye vote, and I will hand over to Mr. Schinkel.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. International students spend millions of dollars in Oregon every year.
What's the name again?
Oh, sorry. I'm Roger Schinkel. I'm the director of the English Language and Culture Institute in Monmouth, Oregon. International students bring lots of overseas money into Oregon. They study in private high schools and colleges. We facilitate the students' transition into those institutions by teaching them English. We have Head Start for high school programs and intensive English programs that help them. We've been doing this because we also do high school placement, we've been doing younger students for some time. And for some reason, it's been working really well for a dozen years, and for some reason it came to their attention. They interpreted the law a little bit differently and had a concern, and this would address that concern.
So I only have one question. So in your particular program, you don't ask for state school support for those kids that are coming. They just pay for the tuition at your school and go there.
That is correct.
If we require them to go into the public schools, like the current interpretation is, that school would have to get basic school support when they did that. So it is a weird situation, and I appreciate you coming here, and just want to make sure that was what I said was clearly correct.
That is correct.
Okay. Any questions or thoughts?
Question.
Yes.
Is your organization nonprofit?
It's not.
It's for profit.
Yes, it is.
Thank you.
Yep.
Depends on the month, though. So.
That's true. Oh. Okay. With that, thank you both.
Thank you very much. Appreciate
it. Closing our public hearing on House Bill 3409, and we'll decide if we can get to running it today or we'll carry a lot of bills over. With that, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3437, and we can have Lisa do a short explanation.
If that's possible.
With a complex bill. Actually, okay, go ahead. I was going to say we could just have you explain it to us. Would that be easier?
I'm fully prepared to do that.
Let's do that, then. That'll save us some time.
Chair, probably it appears complex, but it's really not.
Simple? Okay.
Okay.
And we have an amendment on this one. We've been working on it for a few days. So.
Yeah. I'm reading about my bill.
I know.
Your sound system is very different than.
We can hear you exceptionally well, even though you may not think it is. It picks it up.
All right.
Especially your voice.
For the record, State Representative Jeff Reardon, outer southeast Portland, down into Clackamas area. And I'm here to explain House Bill 3437, talk about that a little bit. May I ask, do you have the magical chart of the system? Does everybody has a copy of that?
I think it's online.
It's online.
Okay.
Oh, and the other chart of all higher ed, the one that you did. All higher, yes, they all got that. Too,
okay,
yes.
Okay, just wanted
to. We've looked at it a few times.
I'll be referring to that, so, okay. I'm sorry, I just came from a great hearing next door, and I had to walk out from hearing a community college student talk about why the programs that we have are so important. And, you know, it just was a great reminder. I wish you all could have heard. It was a great reminder of why we're here doing this work. So, anyway, got that out. Anyway, Chair Roblin and members of the Senate Education Committee, very pleased to present House Bill 3437 to you today. The bill passed out of the Higher Ed and Workforce Development Committee with unanimous vote, passed off the House floor with one no vote. So pretty good day there. This bill is product of several months of hard work and conversations with stakeholders about some of the challenges with our current workforce system. The bill concepts are very simple, but before I explain the bill, I think it's important to say a few words about the collaborative process that produced this legislation. Last February, the House Higher Ed Workforce Development Committee had a week of informational hearings where we heard from most of the agencies that participate in workforce development. We learned that the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, OWIB, and the local workforce boards are the largest providers of workforce training and related services in the state. We also learned that several other state agencies provide similar services, including the HEC, Employment Department, DHS, Commission for the Blind, and Bureau of Labor and Industries. If you look at the chart that I referenced earlier, you'll see a very complex web of agencies that all provide workforce training services or have a connection in some way. So our committee analysts produced this pretty awesome visual. And what we all know, Oregon has a complicated workforce and education system. It's not always easy to know who's doing what. It's also not easy to know how each of these entities, which sometimes seem very siloed, are working together, and ultimately whether the state is moving towards positive outcomes for both the people and the businesses of Oregon. I have to believe that we must be missing a lot of opportunities for growth and improved productivity as a state. The committee also heard from the Oregon Employment Department's research folks who told us about how Oregon has seen, quote, full throttle job growth, unquote, this past year, and we've been adding jobs faster than any other state in the country. They also shared that there were 50,751 job vacancies in 2016, the vast majority of which were permanent, full-time, good jobs. That's a missed opportunity. And we heard that the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, our state board that currently oversees the Federal Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act implementation, we heard from three of the nine local boards in Oregon. And we're one of the exciting local innovation is happening at that local level and is connecting businesses and the workforce. And we heard directly from owners of manufacturing, construction, food processing, and wood products that they were struggling to find qualified people, particularly in the trades. And high-growth industries are changing quickly. The needs for industry-specific skills are changing, and existing workforce is aging. We also consulted with Colorado's Workforce Commission, which has been a leader in thoughtful integrated workforce planning, and many of their ideas appear in this legislation. We took into account that Oregon Talent Council was potentially being phased out in the coming biennium, which means there would no longer be a forward-looking group advising state agencies and educational institutions on talent development or promoting the growth and competitiveness of Oregon's trade sector and high-growth industries with a skilled local workforce. So the number one piece of feedback from all the stakeholders was a need for a statewide approach to effective, integrated workforce development. So down to the bill. House Bill 3437 is a simple bill that rebrands the Oregon Workforce Investment Board. So now we want to call it the Workforce Investment and Talent Development Commission, and that combines the OWIB's federal work and the Oregon Talent Council's talent development efforts. So it does two things. Number one, it convenes all of those very siloed entities at one table to talk about how to bridge the connections between employers who aren't able to fill jobs and a workforce that wants to work. And secondly, it requires that the group produce and biennially update a single unified state strategic plan. So it's the workforce investment and talent development plan. It identifies that the education, training, and apprenticeship systems needed to support current businesses and support emergency industries. I'm sorry, not emergency, emerging industries. They could be having an emergency if they're not able to find employees, though. But anyway, looking ahead, 5, 10, 20 years, what do we need as the technology changes, as people get older? So this plan could would consist of the existing WIOA strategic plan and the Oregon Talent Council's talent development plan, reshaped it into a unified one. What's great about this bill is that essentially it supports work that's already happening. Agencies are already doing the work. There just isn't a common place to communicate and to align the goals of the state. This bill doesn't require agencies to do anything extra. It's not another OEIB. Earlier this session, one of my workforce advisors commented, quote, right now it's like we're in a cloud, blindly making uncoordinated decisions that aren't based on sound information, unquote. If passed into law, there would be a transparent, centralized team that ensured all the right players were sitting at the table, making coordinated, forward-thinking recommendations for a state's workforce system. A very simple concept. This would make a big difference in Oregon. I'm almost done. I'd like to acknowledge and thank everyone who's been involved in this effort. Stakeholders and staff have put in significant time. We've had wonderful leadership from the governor's office, Alana Pertl-Kearney. I always struggle with that. Karen Hummelbaugh from HEC, and Todd Nels is going to be up here shortly. But they've all really gone the extra mile to make sure this happened. I believe House Bill 3437A will catalyze businesses and our workforce to be better positioned and equipped for personal and economic success. Our economy is constantly changing. We need to harness the energy and experience of our entire education and workforce institutions with a forward-looking approach. We need to do this if Oregon is to remain competitive and have a strong, growing economy. I urge your eye vote on this bill.
The dash fives, which take out a bunch of the conversation at the beginning with regard to where the money goes and all this kind of stuff, since we really don't have that worked out, and we don't really necessarily have the accountability for that. The dash fives take that out. We have talked with Senator Devlin,
okay,
who is feeling very comfortable that if that's happened, he will direct it to the place it knows and keep some money to keep the talent program and the other things alive. Are you okay with that, Devlin?
I am.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'd point out in my conversation with the representative, I had to correct him because he was calling OWIB OWEB, and we did not want to make that confusion. No. I would also suggest, Mr. Chair, there is a nexus between this effort and
what
the other work group.
Absolutely.
We have. So, and we talked about that as well.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Thank you, then, very much. And we have Barbara Bird. And was there somebody else supposed to come up?
I think Todd Nels, I believe, from OWIB would be here.
They're shaking their heads, so we'll take whoever comes on up. The only person that signed up was Barbara Boyd. And Barbara, my goal today, as I told Representative Reardon, because he's been so patient with this, is that we would like, I think we're all in agreement, we're going to pass this bill and put the amendment in, and we'll actually do it because we're almost out of time. If you can do this in a very short period of time, the chance of this bill passing today is really high. If you can't, the chances of passing it today are much lower. So just thought I'd give you that before you start.
A minute and a half, I have.
But however you decide.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I used to say on something like this, you can either talk or we can pass the bill. So.
So, with that.
I can do this. Okay. Chair Roblin and members of the committee, thank you. My name is Barbara Bird. I'm the Secretary-Treasurer of the Oregon AFL-CIO, but I'm here wearing my hat as a five-year member of the Oregon Workforce Investment Board. And I'm going to skip almost everything I was going to say because Representative Reardon said it much better than I could, and just say that if you do decide to pass this bill, the members of the Oregon Workforce Investment Board are prepared and excited, I think, about the challenge. We're glad to try to help figure this out. We've talked to our colleagues who are on the Oregon Talent Council and think that they bring a lot of good information as well. So we look forward to working on this, and thank you for the opportunity.
That was pretty good.
I'll pass the hat to my colleague here if he wants to say anything.
And I'll just chime in to let you all know that staff is right behind the members, the chair and the vice chair and other leadership of the Oregon Workforce Investment Board to do whatever necessary in the event of this transition.
Representative Reardon.
Oh, sorry. My name is Todd Nell. I'm the director of the Oregon Workforce Investment Board. I'm trying to go fast for Senator Cruz.
He actually, we threw watermelons at each other.
We did.
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. And we'll open a work session on 3437. Senator Lithicum.
Chair Roblin, I would like to move Amendment A5, dated 523, to House Bill 3437.
Senator Lithicum moves the Amendment number 5 to House Bill 3437. Is there any discussion? Did I get that closer?
Yeah, that's good.
Any opposition? Seeing none, so moved. Senator Lithicum.
I move House Bill 3437 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Lithicum moves House Bill 3437 to the floor with a due pass as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? Seeing none, bill passes. Want to carry it?
Sure.
Okay. We'll have. So that takes care of that one. Let's go back to the front of the page. I just switched one. This one right here. Okay. We're going to go open a work session on House Bill 30. Do we need to close the work session?
Yes.
Close the work session on 34.
That's helpful.
37. Yeah. Well, I had another chair tell me they didn't need to close them after they took action. Okay, and we're going to open a work session on House Bill 3029, which has to do with that compulsory attendance thing for special needs kids and letting them stay a year. Is there, Senator Lithicum?
Chair Roblin, I move House Bill 3029.
I'm going to hold on this one right now, just because we're so late, and give some time. We're already 5 minutes over, so we're going to carry over Senate House Bill 3029. Is there any others to May 30th? Any of the other? Did we take care of all these others?
Okay. We need to carry over those two.
So we need to carry over Senate House Bill 3353 and House Bill 3409. People willing to stay for a couple more bills or not? Okay. We're all here, so let's take care of some of these at the bottom that we've had before. So, Senator Lithicum.
Chair Roblin, I move House Bill 2311 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
So this is the bill that has to do with defining 40-40-20 to just be kids up to 25 or 26, whatever. There'll be a number, but not the whole population. Okay. So, Senator Lithicum moves House Bill 2311 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Yes, Senator Hass.
Thank you. I do plan to support this. I just want to get on the record that while there may be some practical merit to this, that I support, that we do not lose sight of the 40-40-20 aspirational goals, and that continues to be our guiding star, our North Star.
Okay. I tend to agree with the statement that we need to look at this whole population, and it's hard for us to have an impact on the 65 and older population that the 40-40-20 has.
Are
but
you picking on
the group,
me now?
Yes, okay. And me, but the group of people who are in that preschool to 20 to 30 basically are the group that we really need to work on. And any time we can pick up some of those other people, the better we can do. So, with that, is there any further discussion? Any opposition to 2311? Seeing none, bill passes. Carrier, anybody want to do that one? If not, I will carry it. We're going to open, this is one that I think we may have some discussion on. House Bill 2666 will open a work session, and then let's just have a discussion and decide if we want to move this bill today or if we want to carry a look at it. Any conversation?
Where are you on? I'm sorry, what number?
Oh, 2666. This has to do with allowing community college students to have a say on the fee structure. You okay? I think we'll go ahead and move it. I know there's some. So let's, do you want to make a motion?
Yes.
Mr. Hess.
Yes. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2666 to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation.
House Senator Hess moves House Bill 2666 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
I think it's problematic given the community college population. It's a different population than the university population, and because of that, you will have those individuals per the 40-40-20 we just described, and those older adults and whatnot who are moving to and from campus activities and taking a smaller number of credits and whatnot, certainly not represented by the associated student body in the same way that those other students might be who are younger and attending more classes, taking more credits. And I think saddling them with student fees while they're busy trying to get ahead is just an inappropriate burden on their back. And so I actually object to this the way it's stated, because I don't think it'll provide the help we're looking to provide those students in a student-run organization. So I just think it's worth thinking about how will we negatively impact these students by putting another fee on top of their tuition, on top of their books, on top of their food service requirements and whatever. Now we're going to put another item on their tail side. I don't think it's appropriate.
And from my perspective, I understand that completely, but in my perspective and the conversations, this is not a mandatory thing. It is up to the community college. It's mandatory if they decide to do this that they include students. The testimony we heard about Lembetton, I hope that people take that into consideration. They felt it was important to get all of their students to be a part of the conversation. And I think I agree with you. If they're going to do these kinds of fees and run it through the student council, student body, they need to take the time to find and talk to all of those kids throughout that system and try to gather from them the kinds of things that are priorities so that they actually do things of service. And I hope that the experience that those students can gain by being actively engaged in making real decisions will help them better understand the difficulties with all of those kinds of things. So I'm right up against the time limit. So that's my comment. Is there any further discussion on this bill?
And Mr. Chair, is just the fact that community colleges are an entirely different environment, and it's not an inclusive situation, and in the case of Umpqua Community College, I would say over half of the students of that college aren't involved the way a normal college student would be, and so it's kind of a misrepresentation to a degree.
And again, I think it's choices that people make. Some schools will never even think about doing this, and I understand that, and because of some of those same things we're talking about. So, any further discussion? Seeing none. We haven't done this forever, and I think this is the last bill we're going to deal with today. We'll have a roll call vote, just to keep you engaged.
Senator Gelser.
I would like to vote yes, please.
Senator Hatz.
Aye.
Senator Cruz.
No.
Vice Chair Lincoln.
No.
Chair Roland.
Aye. Bill passes, and is there anybody who would like to carry the bill on the floor? If not, I will do this one too. So with that, we're going to close the work session on House Bill 2666. And because we are really out of time, 15 minutes ago, we need to carry over House Bill 2956 for a work session, House Bill 3340 for a work session, House Bill 2864 for a work session. And we're going to go over and make sure that I didn't miss anything, since we're in that part of the session that if you don't say it right, you lose it. And I had one senator prove that earlier. We're going to carry over House Bill 3267.
It's next Tuesday. You could still.
Yeah, we have some time after
you
that.
Have time. So.
But no, except I have to carry them over or they're dead.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Okay. That part. Yes. You're right. Okay.
3181. 3029, 2701, 3353, 3409, 3340, 2956, and 2864 are all carried over.
You want to send any new bills, huh?
To May 30th. So we'll have a long agenda that day, too. So come ready to go. And with that, we're going to close our education committee for today. Thank you all for being here. And if you want a red nose for Redding University, I have one of those. It's an activity that allows comedians and others to raise money for poverty, kids in poverty. So if you need a red nose, let me know. I have one for you.
Otherwise, because I keep an emergency red nose on my desk.
Okay. So either way, you can bring your own. Except we don't have a meeting.
On my desk.
Okay. So either way, you can bring your own. Except we don't have a meeting.